This was 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, the sky blue and clear beyond the window. She had been in a coma almost 4 days. As Petronella finished changing the IV bag, she said, "I was on duty Wednesday evening. She wasn't a complainer, so when she said she had a bad headache, I gave her the maximum allowable meds. Headaches, sometimes bad ones, come with this kind of cancer. That was shortly before 7 o'clock. It's been a strange case ever since." Looking up from Bibi, Pax said, "Strange? Strange how?" "Strange every which way," said Petronella. "First, they can't find a cause. The glioma web isn't so large that it's putting enough pressure on the brain to induce a coma. Brain imaging doesn't show any intracerebral hemorrhage. No hypoxia. No significant impairment of blood flow to any part of the brain. Liver or kidney failure would intoxicate the brain with poisons. But her liver and kidneys, they're chugging right along. And it's a profound coma. I mean, this girl is deep under, yet..." She gestured toward the 5-wave readout on the illuminated screen of the electroencephalograph. "Just look at her brain waves." Paxton looked, but he didn't know what to make of what he saw. "I'll give it to you in a few bites," the nurse said. "But it's a whole lot more complex than this. The doctor should explain it to you, if he can. Your girl is exhibiting the wave patterns of someone who's asleep and someone who's awake at the same time. And they're nothing like the wave patterns of anyone in a coma. She seems to be way under, in that deep place where she isn't even dreaming. But look at her eyes. That's REM sleep, dream sleep." Murphy sought reassurance anywhere he could get it.
"I think it's hopeful. How weird it is."
"I don't see how it's hopeful," Nancy disagreed. "I'm scared." Reaching across the raised bed rail, Pax took Bibi's right hand in his. It was warm, but as limp as if it were boneless. "After I gave her the medicine for the headache," Petronella revealed, "the last thing I said to her was, 'I'll keep checking on you.' And I did. I thought she was just sleeping." As with the Peter Piper tongue twister, Pax heard Bibi's clear voice saying, "Quick now, here now, at the still point, neither from nor towards, where past and future are gathered." He knew those weren't her words, that she was quoting someone. Although he felt that he should recognize the source, he didn't. On first hearing her voice, he'd thought it must be an auditory hallucination. This time he knew it was nothing as simple as that, nothing for which he could fault either his hearing or imagination. But if he knew what it wasn't, he didn't yet understand what it was. On the farther side of the bed, where Petronella had seconds earlier recalled the last thing she'd said to Bibi, the nurse turned her attention from Pax to her patient and did something between a shocked recoil and a comic double take. It was one of those moments that sometimes caused Bibi to wonder aloud whether human reactions were these days what they had always been, or if more than a century of movies had influenced our response to every stimulus, so that in the instant between the experience and our processing of it, we were unconsciously reminded of Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, of how they had reacted in similar situations in films, tailoring our performances to resemble theirs, our natural human responses distorted. Eyes wide, raising one hand to her breast, stunned by something that focused her intently on the left side of Bibi's face, Petronella said, "What the blue blazes is this?" On Bibi's right, Pax couldn't see what was happening. But from the foot of the bed, Nancy saw, and Murphy saw. And they cried out. Chapter 6. Chapter 91. The Second Shock of Three. Paxton released Bibi's limp hand and circled the hospital bed in time to see the abrasions finish spreading across the helix and anti-helix and lobe of her left ear. Tiny beads of blood forming in the wake of the injury, which seemed to have no cause, appearing as magically as stigmata. Crimson drops swelled from the damaged tissue and, with impossible acceleration, thickened into the gooey coagulum of first-stage healing. As that occurred, with it came a bruise originating at her left temple. At first, the watered red of a cheap vino on the darker end of the blush wine spectrum, seeping through the flesh along her jawline. Nancy said, "Oh God, oh God," and shuddered with dread, no doubt thinking the same thing that had alarmed Pax, that this bruise and worse wounds would develop across Bibi's face until before them would lie a woman afflicted with some bizarre disease, the effects of which mimicked a brutal beating. As the bruise reached her chin and spread no farther, as it darkened to burgundy and then to plum, and as the sticky clots of blood began to dry into a crust on her ear, a small cut bloomed crimson at the left corner of her mouth, and the flesh swelled slightly. This new wound would have bled down her chin if it hadn't, as the injuries before it, progressed in mere seconds from fresh laceration to first-stage healing. With that, the stigmata ceased forming and the injuries stabilized, at least for the moment. Paralyzed by the spectacle of Bibi's transformation, but then stung into action when the changes stopped, Petronella snatched up the call button that was looped by its cord around the bed railing, and she connected with the fourth floor nursing station. With an authority born of years of patient crises successfully resolved, she told the responding nurse that she needed to see the shift supervisor urgently in room 456. "We've got a situation here." "What just happened to my girl?" Nancy demanded of the nurse with uncharacteristic and unwarranted accusation. Reason had been frightened out of her, and anger rather than unreason had replaced it. "What the hell happened to her poor sweet face?" Murphy put an arm around her, and, in a voice pressed thin by anxiety, said,
"Easy, honey, easy. She doesn't know what happened."
When Nancy tried to throw off his arm, he held her tighter.
"Nobody could know what that was. That was fully crazy. But Bibi's going to be all right."
"Look at her. Look at what's happening to her. She's not all right, damn it."
"No, but she's going to be. She'll walk the board as good as anyone, better than you and me, like always."
Nancy held fast to her anger, bristled with it. And it seemed that her short, shaggy hair responded to some electrical charge in the air. If her eyes didn't actually flash, they appeared to flash, and the muscles bulged along her clenched jaws. But it was useless anger in that it had no target, human or otherwise, and was, in fact, less real than it was a desperate defense against the despair that a surrender to fate encouraged. Regarding the traveling lines of light spiking left to right across Bibi's cardiac monitor, Petronella said aloud, but mostly to herself, "Her heart rate never changed. Or her blood pressure." Pax stood immobilized and bewildered by what he had witnessed, which wasn't good. Whether ambushed or leading a planned assault, he was always quick to respond to events, not the least reluctant to change strategy and tactics. Considered action was always better than considered inaction, but you had to have something to consider. Hard facts, and a set of circumstances that allowed common sense analysis. He knew that the face of this beloved woman bore the marks of a beating, not evidence of disease. Having tracked down some of the worst psychopaths who had made the news in the past several years, trailing in the wake of evil, Pax had seen enough women and men after they had been beaten to extract information from them, to teach them to fear the new boss, and just for the pleasure of violence. He knew what he was looking at, and he yearned, with an adolescent passion for vengeance and with a grown man's loathing of cruelty, to find and kill whoever had done this to Bibi.
One big problem. Anyone not present for the flowering of the stigmata might think him insane if he gave voice to the thought. But the perpetrator seemed to be a ghost that attacked her in some realm to which Pax had no access, and elsewhere that she at the moment occupied in addition to this world of her birth. The shift supervisor, Julia, 40-ish and pumped, with the glow and stride of a fitness fanatic, bustled into the room, received a report from Petronella, and regarded Pax with evident suspicion, no doubt because of his size, but also because of the thunderstorm of an expression that had occupied his face since he had watched Bibi bleed and bruise. Any doubt that Julia might have had about Petronella's incredible story evaporated when she took a closer look at Bibi's injuries and saw that they weren't fresh. She had been in the room less than an hour earlier to reset the cardiac monitor when an alarm sounded for no good reason, which happened from time to time. And on that visit, Bibi's face had been unmarked. No less mystified than the rest of them, Julia nevertheless had the priorities of a good manager in this age of endless litigation. She wanted everyone to remain where they were until she could get the chief of hospital security to film interviews with them in situ. Nancy's misplaced anger flared, but Murphy quickly soothed her, and Julia promised to return in 10 minutes. In the absence of the shift supervisor, the conversation didn't become as animated as Pax expected. The four of them had been witness to an extraordinary event, and although they had seen precisely the same thing from the same angle, the normal human tendency in the face of the unknown was to rehash the experience until the life had been talked out of it, until they had spun off into a confabulation about such tenuously related subjects as UFOs, Bigfoot, and poltergeists. Perhaps they were constrained by the fact that Bibi's life, already stolen from her by brain cancer, suddenly appeared to be in even more immediate jeopardy from an enemy unknown, and for the moment, seemingly unknowable. What little they said to one another was less speculation than words of comfort, and their attention was less on one another than on the dear girl in the bed, to whom some other injury might at any moment be inflicted by a phantom presence. Keeping her promise to the minute, Julia returned with the chief of hospital security, a former homicide detective who had retired in his early 50s to begin a second and less risky career. He was a white-haired, long-faced, large-boned figure with a natural dignity that might have made him seem less like a cop than like a judge, if judges these days had still been as reliably dignified as they had once been. His name was Edgar Allwine. He introduced himself to Nancy and Murphy and Pax, repeating his name and title to each, as if they could hear him only when addressed directly, eye to eye. His handshake was firm, his manner warm, and Pax liked the guy. Allwine asked Nancy and Murphy for permission to record close-ups of their daughter's facial injuries, assuring them that the images would remain part of her file, not to be distributed beyond a limited number of the medical staff. He'd hardly begun to operate the camera, however, when he exclaimed at something, and everyone crowded around the bed to witness another inexplicable blackening of Bibi's body, captured this time on film as it occurred. Chapter 92. The third shock of three. This time, Bibi's face didn't serve as the canvas, and the medium of disfigurement wasn't bruising and abrasion. Her arms lay at length above the top sheet and thin blanket. The right sleeve of her pajamas was rucked up halfway to her elbow. On her bared forearm, about 2 inches above her wrist bones, neatly formed black letters began to appear one at a time, as if her skin were parchment on which an invisible penman were printing his brand to lay claim to her, body and soul. Although the words included no curse or demonic name, the crisp black letters appeared one after the other with such implacable intent that they could be regarded only as an ominous sign, no matter what their ultimate meaning might prove to be. Murphy cringed from this inexplicable imprinting
as if the message were being carved into his daughter's flesh with a knife, turning away repeatedly only to look back again each time, saying,
"This is wrong, wrong. This is wrong."
Against fear, anger was an inadequate defense, and Nancy could no longer sustain it. At the foot of the bed again, she stood aghast, robbed of the power to move or speak, transfixed by the manifesting letters as if they would spell out both her daughter's doom and her own. Pax hoped to hear Bibi's voice in his mind's ear as before, even if it might be as enigmatic as on the two previous occasions. But as the first two lines on her forearm completed a name, and as a third line began to form, he heard nothing except expressions of amazement from the two nurses, and from Edgar Allwine, an observation.
"It's a tattoo, isn't it? A very simple tattoo, perhaps poorly removed by laser and now resurfacing. Is that possible?"
"Bibi didn't have any tattoos," Nancy said.
Nancy's "didn't," rather than "doesn't," suggested an unconscious resignation, a despondency, if not despair, that chilled Pax. When he spoke, his intention was as much to correct the verb tense regarding Bibi as to clarify her position on tattoos.
"She isn't against them. She admires them when they're really beautiful. But she doesn't have any desire for one. She says a tattoo is a means of satisfying one emotional need or another, but she satisfies hers in other ways."
While the chief of hospital security filmed, while the two nurses watched with the puzzled gravity of those whose fundamental certainties were proving uncertain, while Nancy stood benumbed by horror and helplessness, while Murphy bit on the knuckle of one-fisted hand, the fist an expression of his desire to confront his daughter's unknown tormentor, the biting of the knuckle emblematic of the confused child within the man, while the floodgates of the setting sun poured forth torrents of scarlet light that washed against the window, the fourth and final line welled into view on Bibi's forearm, one black letter at a time, and the message, or the promise, or the challenge, or whatever it might be, was complete. Ashley Bell will live.
"Who is Ashley Bell?"
asked Edgar Allwine. No one in the room had heard of her.
"Where is Bibi? Who is this name on her arm? How is any of this happening? Why? I don't understand," Nancy said.
Such misery informed the woman's voice that her husband, usually quick to console and reassure her, evidently felt inadequate to the task. He turned to Pax with an expression familiar to any team leader in combat. He wanted guidance, and if not guidance, then confirmation of his own instincts, and if not confirmation, then reassurance. But here, Pax felt a lack of competence that he had never felt in battle. He didn't know what to say to Murphy. He didn't know what to do. He felt awkward. Awkward and useless and stupid, and he hated feeling all those things. That might be who he was at this moment, in this unprecedented situation, but it wasn't who he had been until now, and by God, wouldn't be who he would be going forward. Since his earliest memories of his family and the horse ranch, there had been a rhythm to his life with which he had always been in step, no matter what changes in tempo might occur. The rhythm was still there. It was always there. The rhythm was a thing outside himself, not of his creation, and all he needed to do was hear it again. Nancy went around Bibi's right side and took her hand, but she seemed either to be repelled by the limpness of that hand or, more likely, not repelled but dispirited by it, by the lifelessness that it implied. Perhaps the four simple and yet mysterious words from which she could not take her eyes, suggested to her a previously unconsidered system to the world requiring that she follow a path of thought she found disturbing or daunting. For it seemed to Paxton that Nancy's distress was of a complex character, that it wasn't solely grief prompted by the calamity that had befallen her daughter. Whatever other fears and worries might be troubling her, she turned from the bed and went to the window and stood staring out into the vast sky, where gulls rode through an ocean of air or caught waves of wind and surfed without need to consider an approaching shore. Edgar Allwine had yet to film anyone's statement regarding the inexplicable appearance of the injuries to Bibi's face. Just as he was about to start with Petronella, the door opened, and a youngish physician in a white lab coat entered, having been informed of the extraordinary stigmata, but not yet of the four-word tattoo. He went directly to the patient, and was equally astonished and concerned by what he saw. He brought himself up to speed by listening attentively as Petronella told her story to Allwine's camera. The evident depth and sincerity of the doctor's concern disposed Pax to like the man even before they were introduced. As they shook hands, Dr. Sanjay Chandra said,
"When I told Bibi that she had 1 year to live, she gave me this look, such a look. I don't think I could have broken eye contact if I tried, and she said, 'Really, just 1 year? We'll see. We'll see.' I've been so impressed with her, I've allowed myself the unallowable to think that, well, maybe she'll gain another year or two, even be the first to beat this thing, maybe do the impossible. But now this coma and these phenomena, I've no idea what to make of this. I'll need extensive consultation with colleagues, other oncologists, neurologists. I don't even know who yet."
He rounded the bed to Bibi's left side, to the EEG workstation that stood on a trolley cart. As he used the keyboard and pointed things of interest that he called forth on the monitor, he spoke of the five brain waves: gamma, beta, alpha, theta, delta. Of their frequency ranges, their amplitude, their purpose in optimal mental functioning. At times, there were 20 wave-tracking readouts on the screen at once, not five. But they represented the feeds from the many electrodes in the electrocap that Bibi wore. The system was also capable of 3D brain mapping from four perspectives, and Dr. Chandra brought some of those images onto the screen, not maps of Bibi's brain in the moment, but selected studies from the past few days, about which he had particular comments. There were as well a feature called coherence analysis and another called power spectra displays. Pax understood more of it than he might have if anyone but Dr. Chandra had explained it, though most of the information passed as far over his head as a 747 at cruising altitude. He came away with the essence of the situation, however, and that was enough to confirm what he suspected. Something unprecedented was happening. Something as consequential as it was strange. It might be a historic development in the annals of medicine, but perhaps historic also in a broader sense. Each of the five brain waves was indicative of a specific brain function, and there was an ideal level that represented superior performance. Gamma waves were associated with learning, cognition, perception, information processing, and the binding of all senses into a coherent order. Too little gamma activity signified learning disabilities and depression. Too much was linked to anxiety and stress. Optimal beta waves ensured good memory and problem solving. Ideal alpha waves were present when you were relaxed, but with good focus, not daydreaming. Model theta waves meant your creativity, emotional connection, and intuition were all humming at their peak. Optimal delta wave patterns were present when your immune system and natural healing capacity were fully engaged, and also indicated deep, restful sleep.
"When you're awake," Dr. Chandra said, "the five brain waves are ever present, but only one is dominant at any one time, depending on what state of consciousness you're in."
Murphy and Nancy must have heard this before, but she turned her back to the window to listen, and Murphy moved close to Pax, giving his full attention to the physician, as did the two nurses. Edgar Allwine filmed Dr. Chandra, perhaps not so much as part of his litigation prevention file, but because he too sensed that in this moment, in this room, history might be made. calling onto the screen a simpler display than 20 feeds, revealing the 5 wave patterns of Bibi's brain in real time, Sanjay Chandra said, "But there is not, at any moment, a dominant wave in her brain. Right now, each of these patterns is optimal, ideal. There is no precedent for this. It has never been observed before. Until her. And it's been this way since we first hooked her up to the EEG Thursday morning, 3.5 days ago." "Could it be a malfunctioning machine?" Paxton asked. "No, that's what we thought. But this is the second EEG we've used. It's reporting the same activity as the first." "What does it mean?" Allwine asked, prodding the doctor for the purpose of the video. Chandra regarded the screen in silence for a moment, marveling at the 5 dancing wave lines. "It means that since falling into the coma, she's not really been in a coma at all, not as we understand a coma. She's been in multiple states of consciousness simultaneously, while the rest of us are always in one. She's at the same time deep asleep and functioning at a high cognitive level. She's learning and ferociously processing information and rapidly searching her memory and problem solving and being enormously creative, maintaining a vigorous emotional connection, while also deep asleep and dreaming." Into Paxton's mind just then came the beloved voice, clearer than it had been on the previous 2 occasions, the voice that he had hoped to hear again. Although she spoke only 10 words, they were of such importance and had such a powerful impact that, stunned, he gripped the footrail of the bed to steady himself. And had there been a chair nearby, he would have collapsed into it. Chapter 93. Heart to Heart in a Desperate Hour. Bibi stepped out of room 6 into post-midnight Laguna Beach. If something had earlier rap-tapped, scratched the windows and door to get her attention, it was either gone now or watching her from a secluded lair in the white eclipse of fog. Carrying the electronic map in her left hand, the pistol in her right, she walked through dense clouds that all but required radar navigation, the city quieted as if by a plague that had left no animal or insect life in its wake. In the canyons, the coyotes had chosen hunger over a blind hunt and had gone to bed. In their roosts, the birds stood wrapped in silent wings. Only the street lamps, by their regimented placement, could be known for what they were. All other lights, of homes or businesses or churches with pastors holding irrational expectations of late-hour converts, were blurred and hazy and forlorn, robbed of defining shapes, their distance impossible to judge, some of them encircled by faint coronas or multiple coronas, but others like sinkholes of light only slight degrees away from going as black as dead stars. Anything could have happened in that murk. Anything could have taken her if she was wanted. But she arrived intact at Pogo's Honda. After she put the portable GPS, the pistol, and her purse on the passenger seat and settled behind the wheel and locked the doors, she considered calling Pax. Had he phoned her in the past 24 hours, he would have gotten either voicemail or Terezine, since she had abandoned her phone with her Ford Explorer. But of course, he hadn't reached out to her, because he was on a mission, under orders to run silent. And if she called him, she would only be disappointed by the failure to connect. Except for the fog, she wouldn't have bothered to switch on the GPS. She had memorized the route to 11 Sonomir Way, where she would find the imprisoned Ashley Bell. If Kalida's last act of divination had indeed produced hidden knowledge before she'd been relieved of her life and her fingers. In these occluding clouds, however, a guiding voice that precisely counted off the distance to every turn would be a great assistance. She started the engine and switched on the headlights, which tunneled all of 12 or 14 feet into the fallen sky, But before she drove away from the curb, she was overcome by the desire, the need, to speak to Pax as though he could hear her, half a world away, without a phone. This was the romantic nonsense of a child or a teenage girl. But she was both those things, in addition to being an adult, for she remained all that she had ever been. She closed her eyes and took a few deep breaths and thought that she would express her love and longing for him. But when she spoke, she surprised herself by saying, "Pax, I need you. I am not dreaming. Find me." No one else heard Bibi, but she came through loud and clear to Paxton. "Pax, I need you. I am not dreaming. Find me." If, since entering the hospital room, he hadn't twice before heard her voice, he might have thought he imagined this, or might have wasted time trying to explain it away. The previous two incidents, the tongue twister involving Petronella's name, and the stuff about still point where past and future were gathered, had prepared him to accept the reality of the phenomenon and to remain alert to every word that might come and to the nuances of what she said. Unlike the former transmissions, or whatever they were, this one was directed to him by name. Comatose, apparently unaware of everyone around her, Bibi must, in fact, know that he had arrived. He'd read of coma patients who, on recovering, reported hearing every word spoken while they'd been apparently insensible. If anyone, in such an isolate condition, would remain firmly anchored to the wakeful realm above the waterline of sleep, it would be his Bibi, who so loved the world and all its wonders. Furthermore, she'd spoken to him the moment Dr. Chandra had said that she was in multiple stages of consciousness simultaneously, while also deep asleep and dreaming. She must have heard the physician, and she had specifically said that she was not dreaming, in spite of what could be read in the brainwaves, in spite of the rapid eye movement, which always signified that a sleeper lay deep in dreams. Edgar Allwine had begun to film Nurse Julia, and those in the room, all but Pax, were fixated upon her account of the inexplicable emergence of the four-word tattoo. "Find me," Bibi had said, "find me." She was lying in bed, there before his eyes, and didn't need finding. Pax could have attributed her request to delirium, or merely to the confusion that plagued the mind when it was lost in the false world of a coma, whatever that might be like. But she had sounded so like herself, so to the point and assertive, not panicked or bewildered, calm and determined to be heard. He didn't know how she could reach out to him in this way, or why she couldn't convey the nature of her plight and her needs in a more detailed and helpful manner. But the restrictions under which she had to function were no excuse for him either to shrug off her request or to wait for further communications that might never come. But if Bibi, in whatever deep and strange place she currently inhabited, wasn't bewildered, Pax certainly was. And he didn't know what he could do to help her. The amorphous fog, writhing in the headlight beams as if intent on finding a suitable form to wear henceforth. The low rumble purr of the car engine like an expression of animal pleasure at the prospect of the journey ahead. The first thin exhalations of welcome heat from the floor and dashboard vents. The witchy light from the instrument panel reflected in her eyes as she met her own otherwise dark gaze in the rearview mirror. Every detail of the moment suddenly seemed to be a portent of an approaching event, fraught with hidden meaning and ripe for divination by crystal ball or tea leaves, or Scrabble tiles. Bibi sat behind the wheel, considering what she had said aloud to Pax and wondering why she'd said it. Although he was half a world away, the fact that she'd spoken to him wasn't strange to her, only what she had said. Why say that she wasn't dreaming, when of course she wasn't, being wide awake? Why ask him to find her when she wasn't lost? She understood the needing him part, she always needed him, and in the current madness, Just having him at her side would smooth some of the craziness out of the night. She was reminded of the key thing she had learned since she'd left her apartment and gone on the run. That she kept secrets from herself. Pieces of her life that had been lost to Captain's memory trick. Because she had recovered parts of those memories, she knew now that they hadn't been rendered into ashes and blown away forever. They were barreled and stored and awaited discovery. Maybe the answer to why she'd said what she'd said to Paxton would become clear to her when she found that memory barrel, hammered a hole at the bottom, drained it, and learned to the last drop what was in it. Meanwhile, she couldn't understand herself or fully trust herself, which was frustrating, but not as frustrating as being dead of cancer. "So get on with it, Beebs," she said. She wasn't the only girl in trouble. Ashley Bell would be murdered and suffer who knew what horrors and indignities before the lethal blow, perhaps as soon as 24 hours from now. When she pulled away from the curb and drove slowly south on Pacific Coast Highway, the GPS began to offer directions, like a little spirit guide in a box. Pax was accustomed to knowing what to do and doing it. Navy SEAL training was an intellectual, physical, and emotional ordeal, a test to near destruction, being torn down so as to be built better. An education Harvard couldn't match, a cultivation of honor and valor and integrity and ethics that could survive even the crucible of war, at the same time creating a sense of brotherhood that would survive a lifetime without corrosion. The intent of Spec Ops schooling was to make you confident, but never arrogant. Bold, but never reckless. Prudent, but never shy of reasoned risk. Sagacious, rather than shrewd. Determined, rather than willful, and in every sense, intellectual, physical, emotional. Strong enough to kick ass. You became a SEAL to be able to do whatever was necessary. And to be unable to do was to die a little. He was dying a little as he watched Edgar Allwine film Murphy's statement and watched Bibi lying immobile in her bed. She was beset by cancer, by coma. But there was something else going on, damn it. Something that excited the medical experts as much as it baffled them. Something that Pax thought might be the salvation of his girl. But he was reluctant to let his natural optimism inflate itself, as it was wont to do, because this world offered more false hopes than real. Just then, the answer to his question, what to do, opened the door and walked into the room. Pogo. His name was Averill Beaumont Stanhope III, but everyone called him Pogo, in part because he wouldn't answer to anything else. He had long been Bibi's best pal, closer to her than any girlfriend. She didn't know where the nickname came from. He had been Pogo as long as she'd known him. Pax respected the kid and found him good company, but he didn't yet know him well. He knew only that with most people, Pogo played dumb, but wasn't. That he truly didn't care about money. That he pretended to be lazy, but was not. That in spite of movie star good looks, he was so lacking in vanity that he had need of a mirror only when he shaved. Pogo shook Pax's hand, but only en route to the hospital bed, where he stood, looking down at Bibi, tears forming in his eyes the moment that he saw her. When Edgar Allwine began filming Nancy's statement, Pogo learned what had everyone agitated. Pax saw the kid brighten as the paranormal nature of these recent events inspired hope. But then a measure of sobriety tempered his expression, as if he instinctively perceived the danger of unrestrained optimism, following in his own way the very progression of Pax's attitude. When he could draw Pogo aside, Pax said quietly, "There may be some things we can do to help her, but not here."
"What things?"
"My guess is, I'll figure that out as we go."
"You'll figure it out, but it's real?"
"No bullshit. You heard Nancy say what happened. There's more they don't know about."
"But you do."
"That's right." Although Bibi had said that Pogo was more a realist than dreamer, the kid proved not to be one of the legion of knee-jerk skeptics who work to make the world a more bitter place by doubting the motives and wisdom of anyone not a clone of them. He was at once game.
What do you need me to do?
Do you have a car?
Yeah, I call it a car,
Pogo said, wiping his eyes with his fingertips, drying his fingers on his jeans.
But a lot of people have other names for it. A 30-year-old Honda, primer for paint, but still sweet in its quiet way. Do I drive?
Why wouldn't you drive?
It's your car.
Pogo smiled.
Man, this could be totally sacred. On the road for Bibi, with the Incredible Hulk riding shotgun.
Part 7. Two Girls Needing to Be Found. Chapter 94. The Girl We Only Think We Know. Pax tossed his duffel bag into the back of the Honda, hulked into the front passenger seat, and pulled the door shut as Pogo turned the key in the ignition, which settled the issue of whether the car was the junker that it appeared to be. It was not.
You worked on the engine.
Now and then.
Maybe it's a Humvee in disguise.
If this baby were a Transformer, Pogo said, about the most it would change into is a 1968 Dodge Charger.
As good as it gets. The 440 Magnum?
You've got an ear for gear.
Pogo drove out of the parking lot and turned right into the street. Pax said,
You had to make some space to fit it, but the body looks factory normal.
Pogo grinned.
Wouldn't be fun if it looked like what it was.
They were going to Bibi's apartment. It seemed the most logical place to start. Nancy had given them her key, assuming only that Pax was staying there, not that he had another purpose as well.
You sometimes think, Pogo asked, the Bibi we know isn't the full Bibi.
She is exactly what she says she is. That's part of her beauty. No deception, no masks. But I know what you mean. She's at the same time a mystery.
She's way deep, Pogo said. She's got these currents running through her. They come up from some abyss, so deep that if you tried to scuba down there, you'd be crushed, you know, by the weight of all the ocean above.
Pax nodded.
Sometimes, it's like she doesn't know about herself, what you just said.
Braking to a stop at a red traffic light, Pogo spoke without glancing at Pax, though they were both wearing sunglasses and were therefore somewhat armored against the revelation of sentimentality.
I don't know if I'll ever love anybody as much as Biebs. She's a sister to me. Sister and brother and best friend. She's the whole package. It means so much, man. I wouldn't ever try for anything else and spoil the way it is.
I know. You don't have to say it. She feels the same.
Well, I just wanted it clear between us. Made me so damn happy when I first met you, and you were what she said you were.
She deserves me, huh?
She deserves better, but you're worth settling for.
Pax laughed, and the traffic light changed, and he said,
You ever considered being a SEAL? I think maybe you'd make it.
I was born a SEAL, lowercase. Made for the ocean, but not the Navy. I'm not a dude with ambition.
I know, Pax said. Aspiration is your thing, not ambition. Skill rather than money. Honor rather than fame.
Bro, you have me confused with another Pogo.
Don't think so. I know what's under the hood. I have an ear for gear.
They were silent for a block or so. Although the day was mild, the hard March sunlight laid a wintry glaze on window glass and white stucco walls, and even painted glistening, icy-looking edges on the stiff green blades of the fan palms.
You really think we can help her? Pogo asked.
I can't stand to think anything else.
But brain cancer, a coma, Oof. A lot of bad news.
Cancer, yeah. But it's not a coma. The brain waves prove that much. Not a coma.
Then what is it?
Pax had been thinking about that since the third time Bibi's voice had come to him.
We see her lying in the bed, and we think that's her, that's Bibi. But maybe it's not. Not all of her, anyway.
Pulling into the parking lot behind Bibi's apartment complex, Pogo said,
"Tell me you aren't gassing off on some evil twin trip."
When you're asleep and dreaming, you're in a sense dead to the real world. You're living in the dream. Bibi's not dreaming, but
according to the brainwaves, she's dreaming.
The EEG also says she's awake, which isn't exactly the case either. Anyway, she said she's not dreaming.
Said? Said when?
As Pogo slotted the Honda between younger vehicles of higher pedigrees, Pax sighed.
Okay, here goes.
He recounted the three times that Bibi had spoken inside his head.
On one level, she's aware of what's going on in the hospital room. But right now, it's not where she's living.
Yeah? So where is she living?
Damn if I know.
Living somewhere without her body.
I'm not saying it makes sense.
I thought that's exactly what you were saying.
I'm saying, whether it makes sense or not, it's what seems to be true. And she wants me, us, to find her.
Pogo switched off the engine. Blonde, tanned, eyes as dark and clear as sapphires, he looked in profile less like a standard-issue California surf rat than like a ship's captain in the making. There was about him an aura of competence and responsibility that could be discerned also in the lines of his face, though a decade or two might pass before subtle evidence in the bone became obvious to everyone. Whatever he might make of himself, however, he would always be of the sea. Just looking at him, you could almost hear waves breaking on the shore. After pondering, Pogo said,
"I don't know if I believe in telepathy."
"Don't know I do either," Pax admitted. "One thing I do know, wherever she is, even if it is a dream, what happens to her there affects her here. The bruises, the abrasions, the tattoo.
This is Mondo weird."
"I have a hunch when we figure it out, it won't be weird at all. When we've got all the pieces, it'll make perfect sense."
"Totally clever. How you got me to jump into this at the hospital before you let me know what a kelphead mission it is."
"You'd have jumped in with both feet anyway. What's a kelphead?"
"A fool. Bad surfer. Hardly ever on his board, mostly wiped out with his head in the kelp. I was one, before she taught me the right moves." "Find me, huh? How does that work?"
Removing his sunglasses, Pax said,
"Seems logical to start here, at the apartment."
Pogo took off his shades.
"What if we suck at this Sherlock stuff?"
"We won't."
As Pax opened his door, Pogo said,
"What happens to her there affects her here?"
Pax turned his head and met Pogo's eyes. He knew what question would come next, because anyone who truly loved her couldn't leave it unasked. The kid said,
"Then what if she dies there?"
"She won't," Pax said, and got out of the car.
Chapter 95. A familiar house never seen before. The voice of a stern but caring woman, who might have been a nurse or an elementary school teacher before recording directions for a GPS system, encouraged Bibi through fog and darkness. She drove south along the coast to Laguna Canyon Road, then inland along that twisty route, which had its dangerous stretches even in the best of weather.
She indulged no superstition regarding the world after midnight. Didn't believe that she had entered the witching hour when broomstick riders filled the sky. But she had a sense of impending occult menace on this particular night, as on no other. Justified paranoia plucked the harpstrings of her nerves until she half expected that, behind the cataracts of fog, the world was being rearranged like a vast stage undergoing set changes. Balancing that irrational fear was an intuitive feeling that Pax must be coming home to her, that in fact he was already nearby. From time to time, she glanced to her right, with the peculiar expectation that he rode in the passenger seat. But of course, he was never there. As the canyon road wound among the folded foothills, the fog that slowly tumbled like great masses of dripping white laundry gradually gave way to sheer curtains and then to isolated, tattered scraps. By the time she passed under the first freeway and turned off the canyon road onto a state route, no shred of mist remained. And a while later, after she passed under the last of the county's freeways, she came to lonely territory, low hills and arid meadows of scraggly grass, bleak in the moon-chilled night. Her virtual companion, whose succinct guidance had thus far been flawless, spoke for the first time out of character, as shouldn't have been possible. The voice sounded like that of a young girl.
"In 200 yards, you will want to stop at a house on the left."
The highway topped a low rise and turned to the right as it descended, and ahead stood the promised house, soft light in its curtained windows. Two things about the three-story residence caused Bibi to take her foot off the accelerator and let the car coast down the gentle slope. First, it seemed to belong not merely in another state than California, but on another continent. Not here in open country, but on a city street, with other houses crowded against it. Although lacking porch or portico, with no grand steps leading up to the front door, the house looked stately, its brick walls enhanced with limestone coins at the corners and limestone surrounds at each window. Four chimneys pierced the steeply pitched roof, which might have been of slate. In addition to the strangeness of such a house in such a place, a feeling of familiarity caused Bibi to bring the coasting car almost to a stop. She had never traveled this highway before, had never seen this house. She couldn't recall having seen one very like it anywhere else, and yet, moment by moment, it seemed more familiar to her, until she was gripped by full-blown déjà vu. As she eased past the place, a sudden memory flashed into her mind's eye. Ashley Bell, in a white dress with pale blue lace collar, standing at a third-floor window, gazing out from this very house. She could recall nothing else, neither the occasion nor the date, but the memory was so clear and so poignant that she knew it must be real. The feeling of kindredness between Bibi and this girl, which had overcome her upon first seeing the photograph in Kalida's office, the sense of an equivalence between them, a sisterhood, rose in her once more, even more intense than previously. Ashley Bell, in a white dress with pale blue collar, standing at a third floor window. If Bibi had known this child, then here was another incidence of self-deception, another part of her life edited out and burned away with the use of Captain's memory trick. She didn't dare swing the Honda into the dirt driveway and approach the house boldly. There were countless foolish ways to die, but she hoped to avoid the egregiously stupid ones. She accelerated, drove over another low rise, out of sight of the residence, and parked on the shoulder of the highway. She sat contemplating her next move, trying to decide whether it might be egregiously stupid or just stupid. But in the end, there was nothing else she could do other than investigate the house. The young girl's voice that had issued from the GPS might have been that of Ashley Bell. Who else could it have been? There was no other child in this affair. After an absence of some hours,
The supernatural forces that Kalida had let into Bibi's life seemed to have returned. Chapter 96. The Box of Ordinary Things. Bibi's apartment was tastefully furnished in mid-century modern with Art Deco accents. Simple and clean and welcoming, and in these circumstances, mysterious. Paxton dropped his duffel bag inside the front door. He stood with Pogo, surveying the living room, the dining area, the open kitchen beyond, listening warily, as though something unknown and unpleasant might materialize at any moment.
"What are we looking for?"
Pogo asked.
"Anything that doesn't seem like our girl." "That's kind of vague, don't you think?" "It's as clear as could be. If someone laid out three hats and said one of them was Bibi's, you'd know which it was, wouldn't you?"
"She doesn't like hats."
"Exactly. If you see a hat, it's suspicious."
"So, a hat is just like a metaphor for anything un-Bibi."
"We'll know it when we see it."
"We will, huh?"
"If we're expecting to see it, yes. People go through life failing to see all sorts of amazing things because they aren't expecting to see them."
"Do all Navy SEALs have a tendency to go mystical?"
"War," Pax said, "either dulls the mind to despair or sharpens it toward intuitive truths."
"Who said that?"
"I did. Let's split up the rooms."
"I'll take her study," Pogo said. "You take the bedroom. I wouldn't feel right looking through her lady things."
Pax didn't feel right looking through them either, although not entirely for the same reason that Pogo would have found the task disconcerting. When he was 11, a week after the sudden death of Sally Mae Coulter, his much-loved maternal grandmother, his mom had taken him to Sally's house to pack the woman's clothes in boxes to donate to a thrift shop. They also sorted through Sally's books and jewelry and bibelot, deciding which items should be given to which friends and relatives as remembrances of her. That would have been a grim day if his mom hadn't told him numerous stories about Sally that he hadn't known and that had kept her fresh in memory all these years. Going through the drawers in Bibi's nightstands, highboy, and dresser, he repeatedly felt as if he were conducting a preliminary assessment to determine what would need to be disposed of upon her death. In the walk-in closet, standing on a three-step stool, he found the metal lockbox on the highest shelf. It was about 20 inches square, 10 inches deep. He couldn't imagine anything more un-Bibi than this. She was practical, and the box was not. Fire-resistant, but not fireproof, it would buckle in a vigorous blaze, and the lip of the lid would sneer open, inhaling flames. Portable, it was no obstacle to a burglar, but instead invited attention. And what was the point of having a lockbox for which you taped the key to the lid, as she had done? Having finished searching the study, Pogo was looking through the kitchen cabinets when Pax entered and put his discovery on the dinette table. Against the red formica, the metal box with its baked-on black finish looked ominous, as if they might be wise to call in a bomb disposal specialist to deal with it.
"Something?" Pogo asked.
"Maybe."
They sat at the table. Pax used the key. The piano hinge was a little stiff, but the lid opened all the way. Most of the contents lay under a rumpled chamois cloth, which held within its loose folds a worn and cracked and dirt-crusted dog collar. Lifting that item with one finger, Pax said,
"Have you seen this before?"
"No."
"Why would she keep such a thing?"
Pogo took the collar, and as he examined it, dirt crumbled between his fingers.
"Jasper,"
he said, reading the name that had been neatly scored into the leather.
"Did she once have a dog named Jasper?"
"Kinda. Sort of."
Frowning, Pogo pointed to another object in the document box, a spiral-bound notebook.
It's full of stories about a dog named Jasper.
The notebook measured perhaps 6 by 9 inches and was almost an inch thick, containing well in excess of 200 lined pages. On the cover, the name and logo of the stationery company had been painted over, creating a pale beige background for a beautifully designed and rendered pen and ink Art Deco drawing of a leaping panther and a leaping gazelle, each on its hind legs and bounding away from the other.
"I drew that for her," he said. "I drew special covers for most of her diaries and notebooks. She loved Art Deco even then."
"I didn't know you had such talent,"
Pogo shrugged.
"How old were you when you did this?"
"She was 10 when she wrote the Jasper stories, so I'd have been 8.
"You had this technique at 8? Hell, you're a prodigy."
"I'm no Norman Rockwell. Drawing ability shows up early, that's all. A sense of form, perspective. People go to art school not to learn it, just to refine it. I could have. But there's lots of things I could have done. Could do only matters if it's also want to do."
Everyone, Pax believed, was more than she or he appeared to be. And one of the saddest things about the human condition was that most people never realized what talents, capacities, and depth they possessed. That Pogo had taken a full measure of himself must be one reason that Bibi so loved him.
"Why a panther and gazelle?"
"It's just a cool design. If there was a